through which Buddhist teaching was taught. And some of the, a lot of the teaching is taught through metaphor and through myth. And the whole story of the Buddha's life, we all know very little about the historical life of the Buddha, but what we have, probably, most likely, what we have survived, is a lot of myth about the Buddha. And whether it was real or not, it still has a very powerful mythological importance, his life story. And these myths, these pieces of the myths of his life, contain within them a lot of kind of compact dharma, compact teachings about spirituality and spiritual practice. And in particular, the story of the Buddha's enlightenment, the whole kind of day and the night of his enlightenment, is just jam-packed with mythic segments or teachings. And it could all be unraveled and should be unraveled, I think, to find its deeper meanings beyond just a surface of just being a myth or taking it literally, which some people do. And I think that for me, that in part, the value of myth and metaphor is that it points to a much richer and wider world than we can possibly do through rational discourse or rational description. And for one thing, myth and metaphor points to the world of our potential. And we all have this tremendous potential of who we are and who we can become. And it's not really clear what that is. It's kind of the unknown in what our potential is or how it's going to work itself out for each of us. But we all have this potential. And I think a lot of the myth speaks to that potential that we have. Also, I think that myth and metaphor also speaks to the interrelationships, the interpenetration, the world of relationships that we find ourselves in. And the world of relationships that we find ourselves in are often very complex. They have many different levels of understanding. And perhaps we can kind of unravel them all and talk about them. But somehow if we talk about them in a kind of logical way, I think it's very easy to lose some of the richness of that the complexity offers. And as I've been saying, I think, the last weeks, I think there's much more to that a religious life, like a Buddhist spiritual life, is about bringing all aspects of humanity into this world of awareness, this world of mindfulness. And that there's many different aspects of our humanity. And if we leave the discussion of Buddhism and understanding only in the rational realm, probably part of who we are as a human being gets left out. That myth, metaphor, poetry are ways in which of touching aspects of our heart and places that are very important. It certainly adds a richness, a beautiful richness. In Zen Buddhism, one of the root myths is about the semi-legendary figure Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma was an Indian who came to China and brought with him Zen Buddhism. It flowered in China and then furthermore in Japan. And the kind of the root myth of Zen has to do with Bodhidharma's meeting the emperor. And not just anybody goes and meets the emperor of China. And when you are, there's a whole protocol, you know, meeting the son of heaven after all. So he shows up and he gets an interview with the emperor of China. And the emperor of China says, well, who are you? A reasonable question. Who are you? You showed up from India. Who do you think you are in my court? Who are you? And Bodhidharma says, I don't know. And I mean, the story kind of continues, but that's the punchline. And Zen students grapple with, dance with, work with, are inspired by this answer, I don't know. And what does he mean? Why does he say, I don't know? This great legendary founder of a whole religious tradition why is he depicted as being so dumb and saying, I don't know who I am? Is that really so dumb after all? Bodhidharma was the only religious founder of a religious school, that the religion itself makes fun of. You ever seen these Bodhidharma dolls? Mm-hmm. They turn into a little doll, a punching bag. Have you seen the ink drop paintings of Bodhidharma, kind of scrowling with a mean look on his face? Interesting, the way the Zen people treat their own founder. But anyway, this root myth of meeting the emperor and saying, I don't know. And I think the suggestion is that he was very serious when he said, I don't know. Of course, he knew he was Bodhidharma. But in a very fundamental way, very deep, the sources of who we are, we don't know. And that we don't know is supposed to be an expression of great wisdom and understanding. In some ways, that his answer, I don't know, points maybe to the root of who we are. Mindfulness practice, or Buddhist practice, is to meet our life as it is with awareness. And in doing so, we let go everything which limits us and that which identifies us with anything in particular, or with anything that's less than who we actually are. We learn to let go of the constrictions and limitations and identifications we have that we think that keeps us confined to being less than who we truly are. And Bodhidharma's answer, I don't know, my suggestion is his answer is coming from the place of him actually having realized completely who he was. So who are we? Very important question in Buddhism. Who am I? What is the self? And as I like to say it, the Bodhidharma in saying, I don't know, is pointing to a very basic form of trust. Which we can understand as kind of a trusting awareness, an awareness which trusts. As someone said last week, you know, we're not trusting anything particular when we practice Buddhism, but we have this trusting awareness. Almost as if it's enough just to be aware. We're finding a way of being where it's enough just to be aware. And that in Buddhism, the word sacred doesn't exist in Buddhism, and maybe it's different things you can point to in Buddhism as being sacred. But one of the things I think is being sacred for myself in Buddhism is awareness itself. That awareness, our awareness is a sacred realm, a sacred world. And one of the beautiful things about that is that we bring our awareness to everything we experience, everything that we meet. So we meet everything in the world, in a sense, with this thing that's sacred. Or we envelop everything with sacredness, with awareness. Whether you see this see awareness as being sacred or not, the possibility of awareness, that we can bring awareness to everything we experience, means that we have the possibility of becoming free. The possibility of freedom and peace exists in the possibility of becoming aware. And I believe that the possibility of becoming free and being at peace, of trusting this kind of awareness, is something which we all innately feel or sense or have some kind of sense of. Someone has pointed out that a lot more goes on when Americans go fishing than fishing for fish. That for some men, maybe women also, that maybe perhaps going fishing in the rivers is... you're sitting there for hours and hours not getting anything. Maybe they're not expecting to get anything. Maybe it's their chance, the way we do when we meditate, to let everything else fall off us, to slough off all our concerns and worries, and find some way of being that we can be simply be at rest. So what I want to talk about this evening is what's known as the three watches of the night. This is one aspect of the myth of the Buddha's enlightenment. And as the story goes, after the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, committed to become enlightened that night, however long it took. And at the beginning, he was assailed by all his doubts and fears and insecurities, all his passions and desires. And once he kind of gone through that layer of who he was, then he passed through three stages, or three watches of the night, three periods of the night, where he had three different knowledges. He attained three, what's known as three different knowledges. And in the world, you know, if you take the myth literally, it's pretty far out. What his knowledges are. But my suggestion is that they weren't originally meant to be taken literally, that they belong to the world of myth, and we have to unpack them. We have to kind of, in some sense, interpret them for ourselves. Part of the value of mythology and metaphor is that it allows each generation of practitioners to interpret some root metaphor, root stories, in language and understanding that fits their time and age. So the myths, the Buddhist myths, are something we have to, in some ways, re-enliven, re-vitalize every generation. So I'll try to do a little bit with this story of the three watches of the night. So as we all know, the basic practice of mindfulness is learning to be present with things as they are, just as they are, without any expectations or evaluations or any kind of striving or goal beyond that. One of the things that happens when you simply allow your presence for the way things are is we tend to relax, let go of all the conditionings and all the structure which holds our worldview and personal view together. We begin to soften or relax the selective way in which we see the world, in which we remember our world, or remember our past and what happened to us. Or maybe we can say, I have written down my notes, we let go of the selective way in which we choose to see and remember the world, so that some other kind of understanding of the world can arise, something that doesn't necessarily come out of our selectivity, our opinions. So it's giving ourselves a chance, sitting still, being quiet, and giving ourselves a chance to allow some other vision, understanding of the world to occur. And that's not always, you know, our culture certainly, we should know, doesn't support this. And I thought this was kind of a nice kind of cute kind of depiction of this. This is from the Chronicle a week or two ago, a Dear Lara column. And apparently, you know, she's talking about Jon Kabat-Zinn because he was in television. She was on the Susan Sikora show. So she says, I was on the Susan Sikora show earlier, and Jon Kabat-Zinn of the book Wherever You Go, There You Are, the man I was on with. So those of you who don't know him, Jon Kabat-Zinn is a kind of a Vipassana mindfulness teacher. So he was on the show, and he got three raisins out of his bag so that we three could show TV viewers how it takes 5 minutes to truly enjoy a raisin. But his media escort was looking at her watch, and Susan was listening to her headphone, and you could almost hear the little voice in the air screaming, is he nuts? John put his raisins away. The last time we had true mindfulness on the media, Mr. Rogers was peacefully feeding the fish on national TV. So at least on television, it's not so good to teach mindfulness. So in the first watch of the night, the knowledge that Buddha attained was called the knowledge of seeing his many past lives. And its depiction in the scriptures are quite dramatic. because he remembered one past life, he remembered five past lives, he remembered 10 past lives, he remembered 100 past lives, he remembered what family he was born in, and what his name was, and what his caste was, and his work, and he remembered 100 past lives, he remembered 10,000 past lives, and he remembered 100 million past lives. He's remembered it all, this whole series of past lives of who he was. And seeing this whole long chain of his rebirths and who he was. So aside from the question of rebirth, which we don't have to deal with, is this a myth? And if it's a myth, how do we understand it? One way that I understand it is that one of the things that happens as we sit quietly and release the structures, the conditioning on our life, the selective way in which we see our life, remember our life, is that memories often surface and arise in our sitting. And especially for a lot of people, it happens on longer retreats. Sometimes it happens as you sit a little bit every day, but if you sit for a whole day, or you sit for a week or something on a retreat, there's something about the stilling of the surface consciousness which allows deeper things to kind of surface, memories often arise. And sometimes meditators think, well, the point is to be in the present. And here I'm having these memories, I'm doing a meditation wrong. And then you can beat yourself up for that. And that's not really so useful. I think it's a natural process of the unfolding of our inner life, that as we learn to be more present in the present, more fully present, that in a funny kind of way, sometimes what arises in that freedom of being in the present is memories. And it's all kinds of memories that might arise, but my impression is, from my own experience and from the people I've talked to about this, is that it often has some kind of significance, these memories. Not that we have to search for the significance or the meaning. Sometimes they're very joyful or happy memories. And I think last week I told you about my experience as a 10-year-old on the bus. And often young kids will have these very spontaneous feelings of wholeness, great joy and settledness and peace. And for me, I'd forgotten about this until I started doing meditation. And something that happened in the quiet and the release of meditation, this memory of wholeness, of completeness, resurfaced, not just kind of as memory, but kind of in a physical way. And actually, I had a lot for myself. I had a lot of memories from my childhood. Actually, they were quite blissful, quite enjoyable. But the ways I used to fall asleep at night when I was a child, which were often quite delightful. And then also there was a lot of unpleasant memories, that maybe unfinished business. I don't know, what was going on. I remember times when I had near accidents. Vividly, I remember kind of almost falling off a cliff skiing once, and I hadn't thought about this for 15 years maybe. And suddenly I was like amazed that I was alive. His memories just came up kind of dramatically, vividly for me. A lot of my fears that I had as a child revisited me as I started sitting. Many memories sometimes occur, and they don't. It's not, as I said earlier, it's not a sidetrack of the meditation. It's a sidetrack to the meditation if we get involved in them, we indulge in them, start trying to analyze them, figuring them out, or try to indulge in them until we have more and more of them, enjoy the pleasant ones, and push away the unpleasant ones. But it's not a sidetrack of the meditation if you simply allow them to be in the present and embrace them with the equanimity of full awareness. Don't try to do anything special with them. Just see them as, oh, this is what's happening now. And I don't know what's really going on so much, why we have to have these memories again. Some of us at least didn't have them. Maybe in part it's the release, it's for letting go of the selective way in which we create our history, create our memory. In order to create an identity, we need a memory, we need a history. And to the degree in which we create an identity, we also create our history. And it's kind of pretty much kind of accepted now in modern whatever, psychology, that memory is not, our memory is not a fixed and accurate and true record of what happened in the past. That the memories we have in the past are in all kinds of ways selective memories, and we choose out different things because it fits into our identity, who we think we are, what we think should have happened. So in part, when we kind of relax enough and trust enough in the present, we no longer need to have that kind of identity and that kind of reconstruction of the present by having to reconstruct certain kind of past. That the past can kind of appear more as it really was, maybe, in part. But I don't know if it's ever possible to get to an accurate depiction of the past. But what is possible is, what maybe one of the things that's happening in the reliving of memory, of memories, is that we recreate, we're always creating, we recreate our past in ways which are appropriate, more appropriate for the present. That the release of the constrictions and constructions of that we have our life in, the release of that, allows us to recreate creatively our past, our memories, in such a way that it serves us better for, maybe that's not even the right way to talk about it, so that it's understood within another kind of context. It's understood perhaps in the context of our spiritual understanding, or it's understood in the context of a very fundamental kind of trust which comes from this practice. And perhaps this illustrates it to some degree, of how we can recreate in healthy ways, appropriate ways, our past or our present. This is a woman here in Palo Alto, a therapist named Rachel Naomi Remen. Maybe some of you know her. So she writes, as a physician, I had a man come into my practice with bone cancer. His leg was removed at the hip to save his life. He was 24 years old when I started working with him, and he was a very angry man with a lot of bitterness. He felt a deep sense of injustice and a very deep hatred for all well people, because it seemed so unfair to him that he had suffered this terrible loss so early in life. I worked with this man through his grief and rage and pain, using painting, imagery, and deep psychotherapy. After working with him for more than 2 years, there came a profound shift. He began coming out of himself. Later, he started to visit other people who had suffered severe physical losses, and he would tell me the most beautiful and wonderful stories about these visits. Once he visited a young woman who was almost his own age. It was a hot day in Palo Alto, and he was in his running shorts, so his artificial leg showed when he came into her hospital room. The woman was so depressed about the loss of both her breasts that she wouldn't even look at him, wouldn't pay attention to him. The nurses had left her radio playing, probably in order to cheer her up. So, desperate to get her attention, he unstrapped his leg and began dancing around the room on one leg, snapping his fingers to the music. She looked at him in amazement and then burst out laughing and said, "Man, if you can dance, I can sing." It was a year following this that we sat down to review our work together. He talked about what was significant to him, and then I shared what was significant in our process. As we were reviewing our 2 years of work together, I opened his file and there discovered several drawings he had made early on. I handed them to him. He looked at them and said, "Oh, look at this." He showed me one of his earliest drawings. I had suggested to him that he draw a picture of his body. He had drawn a picture of a vase, and running through the vase was a deep black crack. This was the image of his body, and he had taken a black crayon and had drawn the crack over and over again. He was grinding his teeth with rage at the time. It was very, very painful because it seemed to him that this vase would never function as a vase again. It could never hold water. Now, several years later, he came to this picture and looked at it and said, "Oh, this one isn't finished. And I said, extending the box of crayons, why don't you finish it? He picked the yellow crayon and looking and putting his finger on the crack, he said, you see here where it's broken? This is where the light comes through. And with a yellow crayon, he drew light streaming through the crack in his body. We can grow strong at the broken places. So I don't know how well this illustrates my point, but certain things, you know, our past, our memories, can never be erased, but they can be understood in new ways. And this young man understood it, his own past, his own pain, his own present, in a new way that I think was much more healthy, much healthier than the way he understood it before. Perhaps we can say that as we sit, as we do meditation practice, that the kind of memories that surface and we allow to surface in the midst of meditation are then informed by a sense of our wholeness or a sense of our trust. And that informing of is the healthy recreation or the healthy reappropriation or the healthy understanding of our past. In this sense, the remembering is not catharsis. Let me make that point. It's not a kind of catharsis. Another way of understanding this first watch of the night, the knowledge of his past lives, is that it has to do with understanding, kind of, in some sense, our identity, who we are. And who we are is we're not a solid individual thing, but we're made up of streams. There's streams that run through us. And who we are is the bounding of these many different flowing streams that kind of pass through us, that started in the past and continue into the future. And many of these streams that pass through us, we can say, are almost impersonal. And I can see that in my own life. If I just review my own perhaps you could say, maybe you could say my former lives, the lives that I knew through my father, my grandfather, and great-grandfather. I've known all my great-grandparents in my lifetime, and some of them I knew pretty much as I was growing up. And so I've known, kind of including myself, I guess, four generations of me. And I could see how certain traits, especially in my father's side, certain traits, existed in my grandfather, my great-grandfather, existed in my grandfather, existed in my father, and guess what? It exists in me. You kind of have a certain stream of personality. Is that who I am? Am I that? Those personality traits that I recognize, is that who I am? Of course it is. But also it's not who I am. It's something that existed before me. It's passing through me. If I have children, I'll probably pass it on to them. And I think I've mentioned this before, that I was ordained about 12 years ago as a Zen priest. And when I was ordained, my mother reminded me that there's a family tree, a book, a family tree that was put together by a company that does these things. It takes her family back in Norway to about the 1400s when they came from Denmark. And so these beautiful, you know, little picture and story of everybody. And almost every man in all those, 500 years was either a soldier or a priest. And here I was becoming a priest. You know, was it my choice? What was going on here? You know, was I part of a stream that, you know, luckily I became a priest? You know, who are we? What's going on? What are the streams to who we are? Many streams of who we are. And then there's our Dharma streams, which I'm fond of talking about. the streams of the people who have practiced and bring us the teachings that go through back through many generations. And we're a continuation of a whole stream of our Dharma family. People who come into practice become part of another family. And you're part of this family, you also then participate in this wonderful living stream. Who are we? And you maybe, I don't know, again, I don't know how well this fits in. I'm sure you'll be very forgiving. This poem is called Ego Tripping. Is that a good talk for a Buddhist, good poem for a Buddhist talk? I was born in the Congo. I walked the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to control my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from her birth pains create denial. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I am a gazelle, so swift you can't catch me. For a birthday present, when he was 3, I gave my son Hannibal an elephant. He gave me Rome, Mother's Day. My strength flows ever on. My son Noah built an ark, and I stood proudly at the helm as we sailed on a soft summer day. I turned myself into myself, and I was Jesus. Men intone my loving name, all praises, all praises. I am the one who would save. I sow diamonds in my backyard. My bowels deliver uranium. The filings from my fingernails are the semi-precious jewels in a trip north. I caught a cold and blew my nose, giving oil to the Arab world. I am so hip, even my ears are correct. I sailed west to reach east and had to round off the earth as I went. The hair from my head thinned and gold was laid across 3 continents. I am so perfect, so divine, so ethereal, so surreal, I cannot be comprehended except by my permission. I mean, I can fly like a bird in the endless sky. So who are we? Who do we so in the first night of our watch, who do we remember we are? Who do we recollect ourselves as being? Many different streams. There's much that we are. So then the second night, of the second watch of the night, the Buddha had a second knowledge. The second knowledge is known as the knowledge of the arising and passing of beings. So the first knowledge was about the past, kind of seeing his past. And the second knowledge, in a sense, is maybe either about the present, perhaps, or maybe a little bit of the future, what's happening to people. And that's the Buddha's ability to kind of survey the world as it exists now and see all beings that exist in the world, everybody. Not only this world, but all possible worlds, and be able to discern how they're going to be reborn, what the consequences are of their actions, what's going to happen to them in response to their karma, the arising and passing, the rebirth of many beings. So again, without delving into the question of rebirth, I think that at some point, as we practice, the practice itself not only opens us up to ourselves personally, our own personal history, but also opens us up in a very dramatic way to the world around us. And we begin to see and understand and be sensitive to what we can call maybe the rising and passing of life around us, the joys and the sorrows that befall people, that make up human life. It's becoming sensitive at some point to this great cosmic dance of joy and suffering. And I think with this knowledge, perhaps comes an understanding that suffering is not just simply a personal issue. that suffering is not only an individual problem, which maybe sometimes we think, oh, my suffering, you know, it's so horrible, so bad, but that suffering is a universal experience. It's a universal phenomenon. We understand that suffering is joy, suffering is part of the whole world of our humanity, and that the suffering we have, in some sense, is not any different than suffering of anybody else. Then our suffering is a participation, in a sense, in a universal form of suffering. At least this is how I understand a story. I was going to say a beautiful story. Maybe it is beautiful, I don't know. I've been thinking for the last 2 weeks for this story, carrying around with me like a koan, trying to understand its many sides. There's a story of, it's called The Parable of the Mustard Seed. And there was a woman, I think her name was Gotami, who lost her young baby son, her young son, and she was completely distressed, kind of completely crazed by the loss and the suffering, and refused to admit that her son had died. And she went around from village to village asking anybody who listened if they had a cure that could bring her son back to life. And she asked, you know, anybody. So finally she heard the Buddha was around, and the Buddha was supposed to be a great doctor, spiritual doctor, this little doctor. And so she went to the Buddha and brought, carrying this dead little boy, and asked the Buddha, can you help me? Can you help bring my, I don't know what exactly she said, but help bring my son back to life or cure him? And the Buddha said, yes. And he said, go around to the local villages and collect a single mustard seed from every home that has not been visited by death. Oh yes, she said, and she was really happy. She went, she knocked on the first door and said, do you have any mustard seeds here? And he said, oh yeah. And, you know, can I have some? Oh yeah. Yeah, you can have one mustard seed. But, you know, tell me before you give it to me, has anybody in this house died? Oh yes. Not just one, there's been many people here. Oh, and then I can't take the mustard seed. And she went to the next house and the same thing, the next house, same thing. And she couldn't find a house that had not been visited by death. And finally it dawned on her something, a realization. She went back to the Buddha, and she buried her son and threw herself into Buddhist practice. And one way, the way I understand the story is that going around to different homes and seeing that seeing a death and suffering was a universal experience that no one is free of, that no one can be free of suffering and death. And somehow that connected her own suffering to this universal event in a kind of way that she was able to accept it. So the knowledge of the rising and passing of beings. And in a sense, I guess what I'm about to say could be seen as belittling suffering, but I don't mean it this way, that we can see we can see the significance of our suffering. That suffering, in a sense, our own suffering, and becoming sensitive to it, has one significance of it is that it ties us into the suffering around us of other people. It makes us more compassionate people. Compassion is nurtured or sustained or supported by proximity to suffering. And then finally, the last watch of the night. The technical definition of this is the knowledge of the release of the constraints and constriction. Well, this is slightly my interpretation, my retranslation. Knowledge of the release of the constraints and constrictions on the hearts and minds. All the things that constrict and limit that constrain the heart and our mind, at some point are free, when you're completely open and completely trusting. And this is the kind of Buddhist contribution to spirituality. The first two knowledges were common in Indian religions at the time of the Buddha. Lots of people had remembered past lives and could see, you know, the rising and passing of beings. It wasn't considered, you know, such a real special kind of attainment. It just happens. The knowledge of the release from the constraints on the heart and the mind, that was said to be the particularly Buddhist experience. And that's the experience of awakening or enlightenment. Realizing that, at least for a moment, maybe not forever, at least for a moment, for a minute, or for some time, you have the experience of a kind of an awareness, a kind of a presence of heart, a presence of mind, that is unobstructed, unencumbered by anything, by any limitation you can put on it. And this is, as I like to say, is the kind of awareness, the kind of heart that is unconditionally trusting. Part of this knowledge for the Buddha was the understanding or penetration into the teaching of no self, realizing that there's no agent. So in a sense, the first watch was, you know, seeing his own karmic patterns in life, the stream. And the third watch is recognizing, even though you can see the continuity of certain personalities, certain personal streams, there's no agent to this. That in some ways, this very personal experience in our life is also very impersonal. And that recognizing the impersonality of it all is one aspect of enlightenment, of awakening. Part of I feel a little bit uncomfortable about this particular definition of the Buddha's enlightenment as being described as a knowledge, because knowledge maybe has the wrong connotations. I think it part involves a knowledge, it involves a kind of very particular kind of understanding, but that's only a piece of it, a part of it. And a bigger part of it, perhaps, in a sense, is non-conceptual, non-discursive. Perhaps is an opening up into the idol of no mind of Bodhidharma. That enlightenment has this quality also, even though it involves some kind of knowledge, opening up into perhaps a kind of mystery of who we are, a mystery of life. So the Bodhidharma could say, I don't know. And it's important to realize that mystery and mystification are very different. And we're trying to stay far away from mystification, but that doesn't mean we should avoid mystery. And I'm kind of fond of this quote from Joseph Campbell. He says, people say that what we are all seeking is a meaning for life. And meaning for life is in the world of knowledge, in part, maybe. I don't think that's what we are really seeking. I think that what we are seeking is an experience of being alive, so that our life experience will have resonance with reality, with our reality, so that we actually feel our reality, what's going on. We don't really seek a meaning to our life, but we seek a sense of being alive, a sense of the experience of our own vitality. There's a way in which our life can come up out of the deep wellsprings of our own true nature, maybe we can call it, the wellsprings of this tremendous mystery of who we are. And it involves a kind of trust to be able to do that. So Vipassana practice is called the practice of it's called the dry path, because very, very matter-of-factly and plainly and simply, we're learning to become present to what's in front of our nose, what's right here, right now, without any elaborations. But calling it dry that way, calling it so simple, that you're just simply waking up to what's in front of us in a matter-of-fact way, and calling it dry doesn't mean that it's also very rich. Enoch's life is tremendously rich, and in practicing a dry path, we open ourselves to this great richness of who we are. Once again, there's no time for questions. But if someone has come up with a brilliant suggestion, is that we're going to have some point or other a box somewhere on the table out there where people can write questions. And people might have questions that come out of my talks, or questions about the practice, or questions, or things they want to have to be addressed in the Dharma talk. That maybe you would like to tell me, but don't for various reasons. Anyway, this is going to be this wonderful box where you can leave your questions. And I would encourage you to do that, because I get to know better who you are. That's really great.